So I just want to suggest, it is probably the case that every single one of us regularly has moments like this. But what do? We just kind of like, we swallow it, we move forward, we don't do anything with that. And I want to suggest what we're going to talk about now is that we serve a God who is unwilling to leave any stone unturned. That when things go wrong, ultimately, our God is the one who's going to come and take responsibility for it. He's going to come and find us. The end of our passage from Hebrews says that where we left off fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy set before him, remember that his joy is hanging out with us. His joy is being present with us. For the joy set before him, he, enduring the cross, scorning its shame. The practice of conducting a shame inventory is all about scorning shame. It is all about going to find it and then turning our attention away from it, such that when it tries to find us in the course of our day, we immediately recognize it and turn our attention back to our awareness that we are God's daughter, God's son. To sit at the right hand of God, scorning its shame, and now sits at the right hand of God. In the third chapter of Colossians, Paul says this, "For your life is hidden with Christ in God." Your life is hidden with Christ in God. Now, here's the thing. I read that, and I'm like, I have no idea what that means, right? I mean, I suppose that's supposed to be like Paul must have meant something by that, but like, what does he mean? And by that, I don't mean what's the theological answer to the question. I mean that if someone were to say, hey, by the way, don't you know that your life, like you've died, your old life has died, right? All the shame stuff, we're killing this, we're putting this to death, and your life is hidden with Christ and God. You're like, I have no idea. Like, what am I supposed to do with that information? Do I find this on the internet? Do I go home and practice this in my gymnasium? I mean, like, what do you do with this information? And so this is something that's important for us to be doing all the time with Scripture, is if I cannot embody this, it doesn't mean anything to me. So I would want to know, how do you literally envision, how do you image what it means for your life to be hidden with Jesus? What does it mean for us to practice being hidden with him? That's going to be different for each of us. But it's important to know, I can't just read that and say, okay, somehow I have to memorize that as a sentence or two, and somehow that's going to magically make my life different. It won't, until and or unless it's affecting the part of my mind that actually has to do with the part of me that senses and images and feels. But it is to say that if we are with Jesus and Jesus is at God's right hand, it means that that's where we are as well. It's important, though, then for us to picture practicing every morning, waking up, and the first thing that we do, perhaps even before you go to the bathroom, if you can stand it, the first thing you do when you wake up is, what's the picture in your mind of what it means for you to be sitting next to Dad? What does it mean for me to practice sitting next to Dad? And how does that not just change what I'm sensing and feeling and imaging, even in this moment, how does it change my exhaustion? And the exhaustion that comes not just from my own personal life, but how I am carrying the exhaustion of others who have come before me. One of the things then that we find is that this God who continually is pursuing us has given us a model for this. And we turn to John chapter 21 for this. And this is, some of you, you know this story really well. And it's the story of Peter's reinstatement in chapter 21 of John. And we're not going to go in through it like verse by verse by verse. But we know the story, right? We think this. So it's John, it's after the resurrection. We don't know how much longer after the resurrection. But the writer says that this isn't the first time. This is the second or third time that Jesus has appeared to people. Right? And what are the disciples doing? They're fishing. which is odd, right? I mean, they've gone back to their old life. The resurrection has happened, and somehow the resurrection has not yet been enough for them to change their vocation, right? I'm not quite sure what it is that they think about the fact that Jesus is walking through doors and finding them in the middle of locked rooms. Like, that would be kind of spooky to me. I don't know that I could go back to my old job yet. I'd still be trying to, like, I'd be looking this up on the internet, right? I'd be trying to find out, like, what the heck is going on with my universe that I'm sitting in a room where people are walking through closed doors. But instead, Peter and his men go back to fishing. And we want to suggest that one of the first things that shame will do is it will continue to drive us back to old ways of living in our vocations. It's very difficult for us to imagine having a new vocation as long as shame is in the driver's seat. And there they are. They're out fishing, doing what they've always done. I mean, that's they were called away from that like three and a half years ago, right? But I'm back doing my old stuff. And I'm like living proof of this. Like, it's easy for me to go back to my old stuff. And then they're out fishing, and then this, you know, and they've been fishing all night, right? And they don't catch a thing. And then, like, there's this dude on the shore, and he says, "Hey, throw your nets out on the other side." And it's like, what does a carpenter have to say to a fisherman? Like, I have no idea. Like, what do you have to say to me about fishing, right? And then they recognize that it's Jesus, and Peter says, "It's the Lord," and he jumps in and swims to shore, leaving everybody else to do the work, right? It's kind of cool. And they're hauling in, and you wonder, like, they count them, 153 fish. And they don't just feel like it's a big load of fish, they have 153 fish. They get to shore, and breakfast is waiting over an open fire. Now, what do we know about implicit memory that we've talked about, right? We know already that, like, this is a setup for Peter, right? Peter threw Jesus under the bus in front of an open fire. And so Jesus is going to bring everything he possibly can to help Peter's memory, to help Peter remember. And there they are eating breakfast, and out of the blue, he starts the conversation. "Peter, do you love me?" Right? And we all kind of, we know this story. He asks him three times, and John writes as such that it would appear that he's writing that he asked him three times because, you know, Peter denied him three times, you know, tit for tat, we're just going to make sure we're going to match this correctly. Like, I don't know how many times he asked. I mean, he might have asked him 33 times, but we know this, that when he gets to the last time, "Peter, do you love me?" What does Peter say? What does the text say about Peter before he says? What does he say? He was hurt. And Peter was grieved in his heart that Jesus asked him yet a third time, "Do you love me?" Now, you see, I'm thinking, like, there's a quick, you know, rendition of this. It's like, well, yeah, I'm about to say, like, why do you ask me? I've told you, like, of course I love you. Of course I love you. And I'm thinking, if I'm Peter, I don't want you asking me this in public one time, let alone three times. Because the reality is, I know the answer to this question. And the answer is, I want to love you, but clearly, given my behavior 6 weeks ago, I don't do it very well. And I want to suggest that Peter's grief is not just that Jesus asked, but Peter's grief is that Jesus asking is revealing what is still true about Peter. And that even though Peter is living in this world in which Jesus has forgiven him, ostensibly, right, that there is a part of Peter that knows that Jesus knows what Peter knows, right? Like, there's the sense of, like, I don't really want you going this far. It's like Jesus has found the sore place in Peter's chest and he just puts his finger in it. And I want to say, I'm like, I hear this, I'm like, this only makes sense in God's economy, right? Jesus knows that Peter's still walking around with this. And if Peter is going to lead his church, how is Peter going to, like, convince anybody else when everybody else knows what kind of a guy he really is? You know, put him under pressure, we know what he's going to do. He's going to throw you under the bus. And notice, too, like, wouldn't it have been better if Peter, like, look, if Jesus is going to have this conversation with me, why don't we, like, go for a little private conversation in which Jesus just says, "Hey, you know that thing that happened 6 weeks ago? We're good. We're cool." No, he pulls it out in front of everybody else. And I'm thinking, yeah, it's right, because Jesus wants everybody else to know, too, that he knows, that Peter knows, that, like, things aren't okay, and I'm okay. We're, like, we are going to be okay. Are you with me? And so part of this is about Jesus leaving no stone unturned where our shame is involved. He's coming for everything. He's not going to leave a single part of your life story alone, locked up in a room, privatized, kept out of the view of other people. He's going to make sure that everybody knows that he is not ashamed of you. Even and especially in your worst moments that we all know are true. He walks into the room and says, "See the guy Pete? He's the guy that like threw me under the bus. I have work for him to do to run my church." How many of us, again, have parts of our lives where we wish, even though we'd be terrified, we wish Jesus would walk in and say, "You know this part, and this part, and this part? I'm coming for that." Because there's something in addition that Jesus does with Peter, right? He doesn't just say to him, "Peter, do you love me?" And Peter says, "Yes, I do." And Jesus says, "I know that we've had a rough go of it, but we're okay." He doesn't just say that to him. He says, "Do you love me? Feed my sheep." He's basically saying, "Look, do you love me?" And Peter is grieved. And Jesus is like, "It's okay. I have work for you to do. I want you to stop paying attention to your shame and start paying attention to the work that I have for you to do. I want you to start to pay more attention to me than to your shame. This is what I need you to be doing. I want you out of the boat and into my life. I want you to stop fishing. I want you to stop returning to the thing and the place that shame wants to take you and send you, and I want you to come follow me and do the work that I have for you to do." If I'm Peter, like I'm thinking, like, how can I do that? Not unless Jesus exonerates me publicly in front of everybody else. And this is his intention for all of us. And how does he do that? He would do it in the same way that he did it for Peter, and that is, we happen to have this body, this community, this group of people, us, in front of whom we don't just want to be able to confess our shame, to reveal our shame, or to have somebody else point that out. We need other people's voices to say, "We see your shame, and Jesus has work for you to do." This is where we have said that part of evil's mission with shame is to truncate, is to shear off our capacity to create, to shear off our vocational callings. How many of us have things that we wish we would do if we could only not be ashamed of the consequences? How many of us have things that we would risk if shame weren't possible? How many of us have things that we would do differently if we knew that we had the 33-year-old Palestinian with his hand on her shoulder saying, "I can't wait to see what we're going to do with the next 5 minutes"? This is what we are called to be doing as a community. We are called to be calling each other as Jesus called Peter. We are called to be receiving from the others as Peter received from Jesus. And this is really hard to do because we don't have a lot of models or practices for how we can pull this off. Where do we find these communities? How do we make these things happen? It's one of the hardest questions for us sometimes. We would say one thing that's true here is that, you've spent, a day together, an evening and a day together, and perhaps out of this gathering, there may be communities that will grow and that will be born out of this. There's a great little book called Genesis, The Story We Never Knew by Paul Borgman. Genesis, The Story We Haven't Heard. The Story We Haven't Heard. Paul Borgman is a literature professor at Gordon College, just north of Boston. And he teaches a course on the book of Genesis as a literature course once a year. And this was eventually compiled into a book. And in this book, he talks about three characters. He talks about Abraham, he talks about Jacob, and he talks about Joseph. And in his conversation about Abraham, he says this. He says, God, the God of Abraham, was a God who was looking for a partner. He's very interested in partnering with somebody. And he said, who knows how many people God tried to get to leave Ur and go into Palestine who just wouldn't, like, cooperate. They wouldn't partner with him. We don't know. There's no story there. All we know is that Abraham finally agreed. Who knows? Who knows how many people Jesus asked to join his party before Peter and James and John and Andrew and Nathaniel eventually decided, yeah, we'll sign on. Who knows? There could have been 100 people he asked who said no before these cats finally signed up. We don't know because there's no story told about them. Here's the point. I mean, because we do know that there are people that did join and then left. We know that people left his ministry. Here's the thing. Sometimes making these things happen, seeking these things out, means you're going to walk through a lot of conversations with a lot of people who might say, no, I don't really want to do that. I don't really want to be that transparent with you. I can't take that kind of risk. Are you with me? It's hard. Did we say following Jesus is hard to do? And this is part of what makes it hard. Because people are going to sense, are going to know that if we're going to do this, like we're going to be wading into territory that's going to feel, it's going to be uncomfortable. The brain does not like to do hard work by itself, but it will do hard work forever when it's doing it with somebody else. And then we get a picture of what this looks like. If we're serious about it, we get a picture of what this looks like when we turn to the 12th and 13th chapters of 1 Corinthians. Because when you read verses 14 to 26, 14 to 24 at least, of 1 Corinthians chapter 12, we get this picture. When Paul talks about the body of Christ, right? We are one body. Christ is the head. And then we all have these other parts. And then he essentially, without ever once using the word shame, he essentially gets this deconstruction of it, where he basically says, hey, there are parts of the body that are tempted to say, hey, because I'm not this or not that, because I'm not good enough, I don't belong. It's like, that's not who we are. And he said, then in other places, it's like you're tempted to think like, well, because they're not enough and they're not enough, then they don't deserve to be part of who we are. He said, no, that's not who we are. In fact, we are a body in which when all those parts that are really strong and vital need you, they circle the wagons and protect the parts of the body that need help. We come as a body to practice justice. This is what we do. We can't do this work without, in the end, practicing justice, which is what we said earlier this morning. In the end, we have to search for those parts of ourselves that are weak and broken, the parts that are shameful within us that we don't want to have exposed, and come both to expose them, to comfort them, to heal them, and then to commission them. Right? Do you love me? Then I have work for you to do. Right? And in so doing, we then also corporately in our communities have to find those who are in the same position. Right? We have to find those who are the outsiders. We have to find those who are the destitute. We have to find those who are the less than. And we have to do the same thing. Because when one suffers, we all suffer. Because if we're not doing that, we're going to, here's the news. We're going to suffer one way or the other. Suffering isn't an option. The question is whether or not we're going to suffer while we're paying attention to Jesus. If I'm paying attention to Jesus, that means that my suffering is necessarily going to include everybody else in the room, right? Because I'm going to have to be in touch with you and you're going to be in touch with me so that when I'm exhausted, I won't be exhausted by myself. But somebody else is going to know and they're going to help carry that part of me. But that can't happen if I'm not in a position where I can say to someone that I'm really exhausted. There go the blues, right? What does the community in which you are living look like? Does that community look like 1 Corinthians chapter 12? Now, you know, there's a beautiful thing. If you read the first chapter and a half of 1 Corinthians, letter 1 Corinthians, Paul launches into this commentary about like how beautiful everything that God has done for them, and they're great, and so forth and so on. And he's talking about them being this beloved group of people, right? You notice this? Have you ever read the first part of it? And like, and these people are like messed up. Like, if you then get into the rest of the meat of the letter, you find out that like these people have got problems from here to eternity. Like, they are so, like, they are, like they're doing, like, there's incest, there's like, all this awful stuff going on in the body, right? And he doesn't start with, like, I've got a bone to pick with you. He starts with, I can't believe I get to be your pastor. He starts with, you are my son and my daughter. He starts with, you were made for joy. He starts with, you belong to me. He starts with all this commentary about who we are. And once that is made plain, we start with this sense of like, we're together in this. Now we're going to have the conversation about the things that are hard. Because we first created an environment in which you know that even when we talk about the things that are hard, like, I'm not leaving. I'm not going anywhere. There's no part of you that is going to be so bad. Like, I already know the parts of you that are so bad. There's no part of you that is so bad that when I see it, I'm going to take off. You can't make me go. This is Paul representing exactly what Jesus says to us all day, every day. You can't make me leave. But my friends, this can't just be theological like commentary. This has to be embodied, lived experience, week in and week out. And it's hard to do. But when we are in this community, we then long for that kind of outposting, as we would say, to become extended into our other places of vocational calling. So we would say, gosh, what would it look like, no matter what I'm doing, if I'm, as we said earlier, if I'm a teacher, if I'm an engineer, if I drive a truck, if I do whatever it is that I do, what does it mean for me to then become a person who is illuminating in that place? What does it mean? What does it mean for me to be this transparent in my office? What does that mean? I want to suggest to us that when we create outposts of goodness and beauty in the community of body of believers, we then energize ourselves to actually take that spirit into the workplace. We learn to be able to be transparent in proper ways even there, so that acts of vulnerability, acts of transparency, are just like what Jesus is doing with Peter. These are the kinds of things that we take into every domain of life that we live. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to be talking explicitly about Jesus in all those places. Here's the thing, like, Jesus doesn't need you to in all those places. He'll eventually open doors for him to become the topic of conversation, but I will tell you this. When you are doing this kind of transparent work, people in your workplace will notice what's different about you. So I was telling them this at lunch. A number of years ago, I spoke at a church in Nashville, and there's in the first book that I wrote, there's an exercise that we give on forgiveness and confession. And it goes something like this, that you gather three or four other people together and you make it a practice over a period of 6 weeks. You meet once a week for confession and you're going to tell everybody everything that there is to be told, right? This is about this being known process. This is about being this open, vulnerable book. And I said, and you're especially going to want to do this with people, of course, that you feel are safe to do this, of course, right? But you're especially going to want to be able to have conversations with them in which you are confessing things to them that you have against them. Oh, there's that part. Every single thing that you can imagine, you're going to be confessing to them. Now you're like, and so you write in the book, you'll read, like, there's one paragraph that I spent on that, and then I spent like four paragraphs writing about what all the complaints would be about why this is a bad idea. But here's what happens. Imagine for a moment. Imagine that you have your cloud of witnesses in which once a week for 6 weeks, you are expressing to them everything that could be expressed about your sin, about your brokenness, about your shame. And with every one of those things, you're hearing them say, "We forgive you. Jesus has work for you to do." Now, here's what happens. You see, the anticipatory networks of your brain are always, always scanning the landscape for evidence of danger. And in our communities, our brains are always first and foremost in protective mode. Anything else, like they're protecting before they're anything else. The first thing I assume, even in my community of believers, the first thing I assume is that this is not a safe place. That's the first thing I assume. And then we have to work to getting, like, chip away at this so that we get safer and safer and safer and safer. But there will always be some place in me that really sounds like, if you really find out the deepest, darkest secret about me, then you're going to go, right? And that part of my brain knows this. But you see, here's the thing. If I start to tell people about everything about me that's sinful, at some point, there's nothing left for me to hide. And when there's nothing left for me to hide, my danger networks relax. Are you with me? Around those people. And when those networks are no longer on high vigilant alert, you will not believe how much energy I have to do all kinds of creative stuff because that stuff was just being siphoned off to protect myself. Are you with me? So here's what I tell people. If you want to do this exercise, good luck with that, because I'm in this church in Nashville, we do this talk, and I say, like, here's the exercise, you're not going to do it. You won't, because it's hard to do, it's too scary to do. 6 months later, I get an email from three women who tell me, we're the three women that you said would not do this. And here's what's happened. And they tell me about how their lives have been transformed. I'm like, I can't believe this has actually happened. They tell me about how their lives have been transformed, but then they go on to say, the most remarkable things that have happened have been where we work. That in the place where all three of us work, people have made comments about what's different about your life. These women have been Christians like forever, right? What's different about your life? You've got so much more energy. You seem to be much more creative. You seem to be much more willing to take risks in the office, relationally, and so forth and so on. This is what starts to happen. And I want to tell you, like, this is what the Holy Spirit does with us when we are dismantling this shame piece in the way that we've been talking about. And this is how vocational things begin to change for us outside the vocation, what it means for us to be in the body of Christ specifically. Now, a word of alert and warning. No act of healing is ever without side effects. We said earlier, like, all healing is disruptive. No act of healing is ever without side effects. 6 months after I got that email, I got another email from two of the women who said that one of their party had left their group because at some point they'd crossed a line where they invited her to talk about something that when she began to talk about it, it was too difficult for her to be known at that level and she could no longer participate with the group. It's important to know that even the rich young ruler whom Jesus loved in Mark's gospel had a hard time staying around. And if Jesus couldn't convince him to stay, I'm sure that I wouldn't be able to. It's important to know that no king goes off to war before he first judges how much is it going to cost me, right? These are Jesus' words. If we're going to do this, we need to recognize that Jesus is going to take us very seriously. And when he does, there will not be one square inch of your soul that he will leave untampered with. That will be the most beautiful and the most terrifying thing that we've ever experienced. And in the end, Jesus says, in this world you will have tribulation. And that tribulation is going to come not just from outside your skin, it's going to come from within inside your skin. It might even come from me, right? It might even come because I'm going to ask you to go places that you don't want to go. But don't be afraid, because I've overcome all that. Final word for us is to just recognize that our older brother, our captain, our king, is not worried about any of this. He is with us forever, and it is his spirit that is in the middle of us doing all this work even before we begin to think it. And for that reason, I'm very hopeful for the work that we can do and for the kingdom of God that is coming.